Good morning, everyone. Today is January 16, 2019. Welcome to the Senate Transportation Policy and Finance Committee, just in case you're not sure where you're at. Today we are going to have an informational hearing, one that I've been frankly looking forward to having. But before we move into that aspect of the hearing today, we do have some new staffers and some new members to the committee that I would like to introduce. First of all, we've got two new pages. The first is Brian Larry. He comes to us from Edina via Gustavus Adolphus. Mr. Larry, you want to step out in front so people can... There we go. I'm sorry about that. And then we also have Charles Roberts. You want to step out? Mr. Roberts is from Woodbury and has graduated from Winona. Gentlemen, thank you very much for serving on our committee. And members or folks from the public, if you have any, you need any help with anything, those are the two guys that you go to. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We also have a new committee legislative assistant, Mr. Sam Zender. Where are you? Sam, stand up. I just want folks to see him. If you have any questions regarding the committee, either members or the public, Mr. Zender is my CLA, and he would be the man to contact. And I simply want you to see who you should contact. The third new staffer that we have, I believe, I could get this wrong, is a DFL researcher, and I'm going to ask Senator Dibble to introduce
the new staffer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we have Ryan Majerus, who is joining us from DFL research staff, taking Suzanne Sobotka's place, whom members might know has gone to work in the governor's office. She will have transportation in her portfolio, so she'll still be around. We'll still have contact with Suzanne, but we're delighted to have Ryan join us. He's one of our crack staff in DFL research, and he's been with the Senate for 10 years now. I think, is that right, Ryan? And he's a brand new dad, his little baby boy. So, all right, thanks.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Mr. Majerus, welcome to the committee. You're kind of hidden back there, and congratulations on your new baby. We also have some new members that have come to the committee, and I would indicate that there had been some discussion regarding committee parity this in the off season, and you know, in the What It's For Worth department. I was approached by leadership about having an additional DFL member join our committee, and I will tell you that I readily agreed, and I'm very happy to have Senator Klein as our new member from the DFL minority. And Senator Klein, maybe you could just introduce yourself to the members and to the public. Tell us the area that you represent, and maybe tell us, how did you come to be on the Transportation Committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an honor to join your committee. So my name is Matthew Klein. I'm a newly elected legislator in 2016. I represent Mendota Heights, West St. Paul, South St. Paul, and Invergrove Heights. In my practice, I'm a physician. In my 2 years here, I've focused almost exclusively on healthcare policy. It is a tremendous relief, and I'm thrilled to join the Transportation Committee to focus on something a little, to broaden the horizons a little bit.
Thank you, Senator Klein. And you'll note that we lost one doctor, we gained another, so we are still safe. Another new senator that is on our committee is Senator Jeff Howe from the Painesville area. Senator Howe, would you introduce yourself to the committee and folks in the audience and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be on the Transportation Committee?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my name is Jeff Howe. I come from Rockville, Minnesota. Senator Fischbach's former seat, and so we wrap around basically wrap around St. Cloud, but don't have any of St. Cloud in our district. I served 6 years in the House of Representatives. All 6 years, I was on the Transportation Committee there, and I served a large number of years in the military, all as a transportation logistics officer. So, look forward to bringing that experience to this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Senator. And the final new member to our committee is Senator Lang. He comes to us. I will tell you, I'm really happy to have Senator Lang here because he does have a background in aeronautics, and that is something that has, frankly, been absent from this committee. I didn't know who to talk to when it came to airplanes. So, Senator Lang, you want to introduce yourself and tell us how you happen to be on the Transportation Committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Andrew Lang, I represent a district in western Minnesota. Mainly the biggest city is Willmar, District 17. It's four counties. I assumed I was put on the committee because you were sick of me standing in your doorway knocking on transportation issues and sick of asking for Highway 23. But I assume you'd rather let everybody else hear my gripes. But, no, I appreciate the opportunity to sit on the committee, and I hope I can offer, like you said, some aviation-centric issues that hopefully I have a little insight on and can talk about. So besides that, thanks.
Thank you, Senator Lang. And again, to all three members, I really do want to welcome you to the committee. Looking forward to working with you. We've got a pretty broad jurisdiction in this committee, I'm looking forward to the help. Before we move to the agenda, Senator Dibble.
I think the Highway 14 caucus still outnumbers the Highway 23 caucus on this committee. I count three Highway 14 caucus members.
Thank you, Senator Dibble, for pointing that out. We've got an informational hearing coming up, and as I'm talking about it, Mr. Doma, if you want to come forward, where are you at? Yeah, please come forward and have a seat. During the off-season, one of the things that's been of interest to me and I hope will be to you is sort of a broad category, the future of transportation. You know, what's ahead of us? And I'm really interested in that. To me, there's at least two big broad categories. One is going to be electric vehicles, and the other is going to be autonomous vehicles. So I met Mr. Doma at a seminar, and he has graciously consented to come in and give us his insight on what the future of transportation holds for us. Followed by him, we will have folks from MnDOT's going to come up and testify also. And I will just indicate parenthetically that if what we talk about today, and there's going to be one more informational seminar in the next week or so on this topic also, if it generates an interest for you and you think that maybe you want to come forward with yet another informational hearing on the future of transportation, please get in touch with me because I really do think that this is an important topic. With that, Mr. Doma, if you would introduce yourself to the committee, give us your name and who you are here representing, who you work for, and then proceed to enlighten us. Mr. Doma.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. I am Frank Dalma. I direct the State and Local Policy Program, which is a research and outreach center at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. As I note in the slide here, there are eight research and outreach centers at the Humphrey School itself. And the Humphrey School is one of the top 10 public policy and planning schools in the country, so it's a great place to be. We have about 46 faculty there. In the last year, in 2018, about two-thirds of us provided some congressional, legislative, or other community outreach and information. So this is part of what we see as the mission, in my own personal view, with the university as the land-grant institution in the state of Minnesota. Part of what we do is to bring our knowledge back to the state to the extent that it can be useful and helpful. So very, very happy to be here to do that. Also, I have an appointment with the Center for Transportation Studies, which is a center that cuts across all departments at the university. There's over 150 faculty and staff researchers associated with CTS, and as I said, coming from all parts, so that includes not just the Humphrey School, but engineering and a number of other departments at the university where you might expect that there could be some knowledge to offer regarding transportation. And again, that one part of their mission is to foster stakeholder and public engagement on the topic of transportation. So again, very, very happy that I'm able to represent them here today as well. So as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, I'm here to try and share some knowledge. I hope you find it interesting and useful. I will say for me personally, this is an excellent time to be looking at transportation and transportation policy in terms of what's happening and what we can do from a policy perspective. I came to the university, started as a graduate student looking at transportation policy in the mid-1990s. At that time, it certainly seemed like, in the students' eyes, the debate was whether we would invest state transportation dollars in highways or in transit. And the second question was always an interesting one, because you wondered if transit actually fit the definition of a highway purpose, as the Highway Trust Fund is restricted to. Also at that time, it seemed like an interesting time to be going into transportation on the federal level, because they were moving into the intermodal world of transportation bills. You all may recall the first one being ICE-T, the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act. As students, we had a little bit of a cynical view sometimes, and we just found it amusing that a transportation bill would be named after a beverage. And so we decided there were a few people that came up with some other alternative names. One that I remember was, instead of iced tea, you had hot coffee, which stood for highways or transit. Congress ought to fund everything. And just in a spare moment, my mind came up with the idea, well, if it's the 21st century in Minnesota, maybe it's hot latte now. Highways or transit, the legislature allocates transportation for everyone. And I was really thinking that could be a theme, and then I realized the reason, one major reason why it's so exciting to be looking at transportation at this point in time is because it's no longer a question of just what can the public sector do for transportation, but the private sector is making its presence felt in ways that we have not seen for a long time. So, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, one area that we see a lot of activity that I'll talk about is vehicle automation, also vehicle electrification. And then I would like to take just a few minutes to talk about the third place where we can see really the market is starting to make a difference in how we think about transportation. And that's what we've called this phenomenon called the sharing economy. So I'll close with that. I would like to point out that I'm going to be focusing mostly on impacts on local transportation, local travel and personal travel. There also is a lot of activity going on in inner city travel and in freight. If any members do have questions about those, I can do my best to answer those. I know something, but it's not my area of concentration, so I might encourage you to have some follow-up with some others on those points as well. But with that, I do want to reemphasize that should there be questions as I go, I'm more than happy to take them along the way. So I hope we have a good conversation. So to begin with vehicle automation, this is the one that seems like it gets the most attention in the press and so forth. It also gets a lot of attention on the public policy side. Indeed, just in the last handful of years, the U.S. DOT has come up with three different versions of guidance that they would like to offer to the industry as they develop this technology. And the reason it receives all this attention is, again, related to transportation safety. The latest year for number of fatalities in the United States overall, 2016, 40,000 or more fatalities in the country. One way to kind of bring that home is if you do that math, that is the same as a commercial airliner crashing every day in this country. Senator Lang may have some thoughts about how it is that we don't do that and we don't have that. And indeed, when it comes to surface transportation, we should be looking for every way to try and achieve that same kind of safety record. So when you've got that kind of a statistic, and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has done a study that indicates more than 90% of those fatalities are due at least in part to human error, you want to be looking at maybe there's some technological ways we can help address some of those safety issues. And indeed, it appears that the technology is coming up in ways that could help that. The other reason to pay attention to this is that the private sector is very, very interested in this. We've seen everybody from Google and now their spinoff company called Waymo doing lots of testing, investing lots of money in developing these technologies, in putting self-driving vehicles on the road where they can. Also, the traditional automakers, GM, Volkswagen, Mercedes-Benz, and so forth, are also involved in developing these technologies. This is something that they are doing because they see it as a business opportunity for them. They are not doing it simply because the government asks them to. And indeed, we are seeing some real activity about how they are seeking to change the way transportation can be done. As I mentioned, Waymo, which is the spinoff of Google, it's in that Alphabet conglomerate of companies, in the last year put orders out for more than 80,000 vehicles that from Fiat Chrysler and from Jaguar that they apparently seem to believe they can use in a sort of an autonomous taxi type of setting. They've rolled out a small pilot outside of Phoenix, Arizona so far. But with numbers like that, you think they might have something else up their sleeve. While I've heard various anecdotal numbers, Ford actually went on the record with this one, so I quote them, that ride-hailing revenues, the idea that they might be able to sell the ride rather than sell the vehicle, could lead to over $202 billion in revenue to them by 2026. And when the vehicles aren't moving people, they believe they could make another $130 billion by having those vehicles deliver packages. So this is a real change in the business model and business opportunity that as public policymakers we should be paying attention to because it will see the market trying to change the way people look at transportation themselves. Now, back to the public policy side, there's a real opportunity with the idea of vehicles that can drive themselves, namely the fact that there is a significant part of our population that is unable to drive for any number of reasons right now. If you have the vehicle able to do the driving, that means that they begin to enjoy the same level of mobility and access that the rest of us do because we are able to grab a vehicle when we want it to take it where we want to go. And indeed, this is an expectation. The American with Disabilities Act requires that the same level of public transit service be available to people with disabilities as is available to everyone else. And Minnesota, in its Olmsted plan to implement the American with Disabilities Act, has promised that people with disabilities will have access to reliable, cost-effective, and accessible transportation choices. So the picture I have here is the EZ-10, which is the vehicle that MnDOT and First Transit brought to the state for testing about a year ago. There was an interested member of the public who came out to see it, who uses a wheelchair, and came out, and they were able to use the ramp that was on that vehicle, and she was able to zip right on and zip right off and was very excited by that opportunity. Another way you might think about how these vehicles could look, this is Cedric, which is the cute name you get when you take the term self-driving car and smash it together into a word that sounds like a human first name. It's from Volkswagen. It's their concept self-driving vehicle, and I point it out because it's a personal-sized vehicle that, again, they take advantage of the fact that you're not designing for a steering wheel, for a brake pedal, for a driving cockpit, but rather a way for people to move around. And you can have some flexible space within the cabin that could serve people who otherwise have other needs and are not able to get into a conventional vehicle. This also creates real opportunities and conversations for the way we can think about public transit. As I mentioned, we can look at the idea that people who can't drive, whether they're seniors, whether they can't afford a vehicle, even children, would be able to get where they need to go more easily if these vehicles were around. One real opportunity is the idea of a first and last mile connection. One reason a lot of people don't use transit is because they live a half mile or a mile, a distance that's somewhat inconvenient to get to a major transit route, and any connecting services that are there now are expensive to provide and don't run very often. If you had a vehicle that could more or less, if you will, live in the neighborhood, be available upon being summoned by somebody who wants to have it come up, pick them up, take them to a higher trunk transit route, and then return to pick up somebody else and move forward, you are then really increase the ability for transit to serve lower density neighborhoods, whether that's in a suburban setting or a small city and so forth. It also could create a shuttle opportunity in even rural areas and so forth, where, again, rural transit, despite some very, very excellent efforts throughout the state to provide transit now, if you are able to provide a vehicle like this, it increases your opportunity for on-demand service, for more frequent service, for extended hours. This is something that we came up we've learned about and refined by going out and actually having conversations throughout the state and talking with stakeholders. In addition to the safety benefit, which is something that if you think about it, transit, automated vehicles, shared autonomous driving taxi services like Waymo is talking about, those could work really well in urban areas, but things like a safety benefit, that could apply anywhere throughout the state. And so there's a real opportunity to try and bring those benefits anywhere, not just exactly where you might see the market take it first. And in some parts of the state, the population is a significant part of it. They're there because maybe they want to retire there, or they've lived there their whole lives. They'd like to stay in their houses. But one of the first things that makes us think about having to give up the house is when we have to give up the keys. And if we have self-driving transportation out in these areas, regardless of where you live, if you can still have your access, your ability to get in and out of town without having to worry about your ability to drive, that allows people to stay where they want to be in that part of the state, wherever that happens to be, which could be a real benefit for communities in greater Minnesota. And then finally, to start to segue into my next section here, the vehicles that we see are increasingly electric powered. That's not necessarily the case. Self-driving cars can have internal combustion engines, but if we see them become electrified and we see Minnesota's grid continue to follow its path of moving to more and more sustainable resources, that means the transportation impact on climate change and so forth will also reduce its footprint. So with that kind of as a segue, I'll talk also about now what I know about vehicle electrification and what's happening both in the country and around Minnesota. This has been headline-making in itself. In the summer of 2017, Volvo announced that it was going to abandon traditional engines by 2019, internal combustion engines. It is 2019. I haven't heard much from them, but they've got several months to announce whether they've made it or not. In the meantime, that news was overshadowed a few months later by General Motors announcing that they were going to move to an all-electric future. They were not quite as aggressive. Their deadline is more in the early 2020s, and they include all-electric to include things like hydrogen fuel cells. But they are moving away from internal combustion engines as well. To kind of reinforce this or give a progress report that maybe they didn't want to do in this way, but you may recall they announced that they were going to do some fairly significant cuts several weeks ago. To borrow from Paul Harvey, if you turn to page 2, part of that was so that they could shift their focus to electric vehicles. Then just over this last weekend, I saw a newsletter that pointed out GM is apparently shifting 3/4 of its powertrain engineers from internal combustion research and development to electric vehicle development. For those who like to be able to have another reason to buy a Cadillac, that's where they want to put them first. So you can now buy Cadillacs for either the reasons that of status or because you want to have an electric vehicle. That appears to be where GM is going. I also just ran across an article. It was from the London Financial Times, pointing out that we may have reached peak internal combustion engines. This is a different study that I'm citing from here for this chart, but pointing out that there's an expectation that we will see electric vehicles increase as a portion of all vehicle sales between now and 2025 at a steady rate. What is driving this? On the one hand, you're probably aware that the CAFE standards, the corporate average fuel economy standards, call for an overall increase in fuel efficiency of the motor vehicle fleet in the United States by about 2025, and it includes a calculation for increased proportion of electric vehicles to help drive that up. There is discussion about maybe bringing that goal down a bit in the current administration, but the point that I want to make with this chart is the orange line is the expected share of electric vehicles that would be needed to meet the CAFE standards as they currently are set. The blue line is the projected market. People are going to are expected to continue to migrate towards and purchase electric vehicles at a rate much faster than the government would be asking them to, even under the current standards. So we can expect that this is something that, again, the private sector seems to be seeing an opportunity and pushing forward with. Here in Minnesota, one example of what we're looking at is Our Car, which is the car sharing organization here in the Twin Cities. They are partnering with Xcel Energy in the city of St. Paul to convert their fleet from current hybrid vehicles or standard internal combustion engine powered vehicles to entirely electric vehicles. And their current model is that if you use one of their vehicles, you pick it up at one spot, and then you do your trip, and then you return it to the same spot. They would change that so that you would be able to pick up the vehicle from one hub and take it to where you need to go and leave it at another hub. These hubs would be defined by the fact that they would be charging stations, high-powered charging stations, where these vehicles could be recharged between trips. And the current plan is for about 70 stations throughout the Twin Cities. Our Car would be the principal tenant of those stations because their vehicles would need to be charged. But there is discussion that if you've got a high-powered charging going on there, you can also have low-powered charging at the same spot. and vehicles that are interested in plugging into a low-powered port would be things like electric scooters or electric bicycles, which you might be saying, and why is that interesting? And I'll tell you, just wait till I get to the vehicle sharing part of my discussion. What I want to make the point here, though, is that we now have the opportunity. We shouldn't think about this as how do we charge electric cars or automobiles, but the fact that we could now, again, get to this idea of more vertical integration of trips, ways to address sort of this first mile, last mile issue, that you could take one of these vehicles from one station to another, and then you could pick up an electric scooter to go that last half mile to where you need to go, or a bicycle. Or on the other hand, you could take transit to one of these stations and then drive a few more miles in an electric vehicle that's from one of these spots. This is a phenomenon we're seeing in the discussion that's has taken on the term of a mobility hub. And something that you'll probably hear about increasingly in terms of local plans for transportation. And what's driving that is this move toward electrification.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you.
Senator Hall.
You're waiting?
If you would hold your questions, I would prefer that Mr. Doma complete his presentation. I want to make sure we get through it. And then we'll just open it up for questions. Mr. Doma.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'll look forward to your question. Now, that's what's happening in the Twin Cities. I also have some friends who are actually classmates of mine back in the 1990s who are working for Otter Tail Power in Greater Minnesota. And they called me up, and they were interested, and they had some questions about electric vehicles. It's something that's on their radar screen as well. And with their permission, this is back-of-the-envelope kind of things right now. This is not a commitment of Otter Tail Power. So don't take this as any more than just an example at this point. But it is based upon some work that they've done. And they've realized that, well, if we're going to have an increased share of electric vehicles, people are going to want to drive them as their primary vehicle. And if they're going to drive them long distances, they'll want the same assurance driving a long distance that we all take for granted in our internal combustion engine vehicles, which is that you're going to be able to refuel it when you need to, wherever you are. So they thought a good proxy for that would be if you were able to be within 30 miles of an electric vehicle charging station anywhere, at least in their service area. And that's a good third, if not a little bit more, of the western of the state of Minnesota and the western parts here. And what was interesting, at least to me, when they told me this, was that in order to have that kind of coverage, that you would be able to get to a charging station within 30 miles at any point, they would only need 15 stations throughout that entire expanse of the western part of the state. And if you think about rolling out any kind of infrastructure, that is a relatively small investment to be able to provide that level of service. And because we see a lot of electrification happening in urban areas and so forth, we probably won't see a whole lot of electric vehicles out in these areas. It's not necessarily expected that the initial investment costs could be recovered from users of these. That's something that the Otter Tail Power is working out. How could they pay for it? But in terms of being able to provide the service and create a statewide market for electric vehicles, it's something that they have started to look at, and it seems more achievable than one might initially think. And finally, to close on my last section, talking about what I refer to as the sharing economy. This stems from the idea that the cars that we own currently sit most days at least 20 out of the 24 hours of the day not being used. And does that make the best economic, is that the most make sense, is that the most efficient way to do it, particularly if these cars can start to drive themselves? Possibly they could be put to a lot more productive use than to be sitting in a parking space 90% of the time. And the discussion is talking about how do we see a shift here from the idea that the commodity in transportation moves from the vehicle to the trip. And we start to see a phenomenon called mobility as a service. It's no longer I buy a vehicle so that I can get around, but rather I have got, in most cases, an app on my smartphone that will be able to tell me the fastest, most efficient way to get from where I want to be to where I want to go when I want to do it. And this example I actually have here in the picture is an app that was developed at the Humphrey School, Professor Yingling Fan. It's called Dynamica, and it can provide information about your trip, not only the type of mode you could take, how long it would take, the route you would take. It can also provide information about the emissions that might result. And they even have some data that could give you a clue about how good you would feel by the time you finish the trip. So it's an incredible amount of information that can be put into these apps. And while I bragged for just a minute about what's happening at the Humphrey School with those apps, the real activity is, again, on the private side. And this is where I said, pay attention to the electric scooters and the electric bikes and shared bikes, because it costs an awful lot less to put a scooter or a bike out there for people to use than it does a fully autonomous vehicle. And then you can start making money selling that ride. And there's even money to be made every time somebody books a ride over the app. And so you hear about not only private providers that we know of, Google, GM, Ford, get to start talking about companies named Lime and Bird and various other companies that basically did not even exist a couple years ago, but are receiving tremendous amounts of private venture capital to be able to provide these trips. Here's some birds. You may have seen them in downtown St. Paul. They also were all over the University of Minnesota campus, along with similar-looking vehicles, except they were green from Lime. Just this last summer, 2 years ago, nobody thought that you could actually make money sharing rides on these vehicles. Last summer, particularly at the University of Minnesota, if I wanted to have students look at me like I was way over the hill and completely clueless, I would simply tell them, I just don't think I could ever ride one of those, because they think it's the greatest way to get around campus that they could have ever seen. At the same time, we moved from the docked bike sharing that you may have seen around the Twin Cities of the green Nice Ride bicycles to dockless bike sharing. Again, Lime is in that business over in St. Paul. They've got bikes that are not docked that you can share and ride in one direction or another. Nice Ride is moving in that same direction. Their blue bikes do not require physical docks. But they've come with agreements with the city of Minneapolis so that there are places where they are supposed to be left and places where they're not supposed to be left, so that people don't have to worry about bikes ending up on their lawn or in front of their door or places where it would otherwise be undesirable. And in developing those agreements with the cities that provide the right-of-way, it starts to begin to set a structure, a regulatory structure, that you can not think just about scooters or bikes, but electric bikes. Electric bikes allow you to go a lot further because it's a lot easier to take on a hill with an electric motor assisting you up and down the hill. So then you're doing distances that you might be doing in a vehicle, you might otherwise do in a car. And if you've understood how to set up your regulations for electric bikes and regular dockless bikes and scooters, you're ready to start regulating this kind of a service that would be using vehicles that would be on a much, much greater scale. I reference back to the 80,000 vehicles that Waymo has already ordered. And then ultimately to a shared autonomous ride-sharing situation. And if we've done our homework now with the scooters, we're going to be in that much better position to be able to take advantage of it in the future. There are some challenges to this. As I mentioned, cities own the right-of-way. As do other governmental entities. Therefore, they have the leverage to work with these companies that are coming in and wanting to provide the rides. How can you make sure that you are creating the greatest benefit for everyone that you serve and not just those companies and their customers? I'll touch on just a couple of extra other points here in the interest of being able to make sure I'm moving along. One point in particular is that the cities can leverage their right-of-way ownership to make sure that they get money to maintain that right-of-way. For example, in St. Paul, they received $1 per bird scooter per day that was deployed in the city. And since each ride on those birds started at $1, it was a price that Bird could afford to pay. It also gave the city some money to be able to take care of its side of the business as well. And I'll talk very briefly about the information, the data point. 20th century, we all can probably agree that transportation ran on gasoline and petroleum. 21st century, it drives is driven as much on data. All of these apps collect information about who their customer is, where they're going, and so on and so forth. This is information that the company needs to know where their vehicles are. This is how they maintain their inventory. This is how they understand how to serve that market. Cities also have interest in that data because that they are providing the infrastructure and they need to know how to be able to maintain it. How that data is treated on both the public side and the private side is very different. And in either case, the user should be paying attention about how it's being handled because that is their personal locational identifiable information. And so there's a real need to be very careful with this data for understanding the protocols, for maintaining people's privacy, for determining how much identifiable information should be collected in the first place. So I want to highlight that as well. But you've been waiting for me probably to say, when is this going to happen? I was asked that question when MnDOT brought the Easy 10, and the Star Tribune thought my quote was so great that they splashed it across the front page of the section, and so now that's my motto. If I ever put a time to it, it'll happen sooner. If we want to think about vehicles that hit all three of those categories, that are autonomous, that are driven by electricity, powered by electricity, and are shared, they're here. Here's when the Easy 10 made a visit to campus and Goldie came out and said hello too. And the other vehicle is a Polaris vehicle, a Minnesota company that is partnered with a company called May Mobility. They had their vehicle at one of the last meetings of the governor's advisory committee on connected and automated vehicles. So in that sense, the future is here. But I would also caution it's not something that we need to change everything tomorrow. It's not like the light, we're flipping a switch here. It's a matter of many, many small changes coming together that will create a big change over the medium to longer terms. What works last year from a policy perspective will probably work this year, likely will work next year, probably for the next maybe up to 5 years. But also it's time to start thinking about longer-term policies that that will make a difference as the transportation world changes. One key area to watch is the private market. Private capital, venture capital, is going into things that we can't think about until they're suddenly here because we just don't know it. And electric scooters are my favorite example right now. The idea that people share these and want to share them and take them around and it's a popular hit. Was just not anything that we really considered until a lot of money was dropped into companies like Lime and Bird, and there they were. On the other hand, certain facilities that the private sector maintains, in particular I would point out parking ramps and those types of facilities, may not be the money generator that they have been because cars will be parked a lot less. And as those start to be removed or replaced, that could be a sign, again, that the world is changing and we need to pay attention to it. And there are opportunities, again, as I mentioned, with these shared vehicles and so forth, for public and private sector companies to work together to understand where they have mutual opportunities, mutual benefits, and those discussions should begin right away. Finally, other government entities should talk with each other. across jurisdictions, across levels, states talking to cities talking to cities, cities and counties, et cetera, and so forth, to determine, you know, what are the best common practices and best incentives to put forward to create the future that is desired by the public, and rather than anything that's dictated from someone else. So with those as my closing points, I thank you again for the time, and I'd be more than happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much for that presentation. I'm going to lead off with a real quick question and then go to members that wish to ask questions. You touched on electric vehicles gaining popularity amongst the public and the manufacturers. Right now, the gas tax is really an important portion or part of our funding for our infrastructure. Can you give us some kind of parameters as to when you feel the internal combustion engine will become obsolete, if at all?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an excellent question. I would point out that on that slide I showed the proportion, the increasing proportion of electric vehicles, the amount or the proportion that we saw there, while it was a steady increase, was moving from 2% to 10%, and that's possibly at the high end. So that's an awful lot of internal combustion engines that are still going to be operating at least through the 2020s. So since they'll be using gasoline, the gas tax will probably continue to be very, very viable source of income for at least that period of time. There are advantages that come with the electric vehicles. They're much easier to maintain. They have fewer moving parts as the infrastructure is rolled out, so that it's easier and easier to recharge them. It may be that in maybe 30 years or something like that, we will not see nearly as many internal combustion engines. But for the near to medium term, I believe we will continue to have quite a few of them.
Thank you for that. Senator Friends.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome back to transportation. Thank you, Mr. Duma. As usual, the chair was a little bit ahead of me, and I had a question. Just so I understood your comments, this is what we're looking at for the next 7 years, and would you agree with me that it makes it look like at the same rate of increase, 10 years from now, new sales might be 10% of the market?
Mr. Duma. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Senator. I believe that we are likely to see an increasing proportion over past that time. At least that's a possibility because, as I mentioned, Volvo, GM, other companies are going to be moving toward manufacturing more and more of these vehicles. So as the market becomes more and more flooded with options and opportunities for electric vehicles, probably the uptake will increase.
Okay, and then Mr. Chair, if I could.
Senator Friends.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the challenges for us on the committee is to fund the maintenance of our roads and bridges. And so are you able to tell us anything about how the change from a vehicle that sits in the garage for 2 hours to is on the road 24 hours just changes the wear and tear? I might put it this way. If we go to electric vehicles 100% and no more internal combustion, how, if at all, does that change the cost to us to maintain our roads and bridges? Thank you, Mr. Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. That's a very, very another area that's very exciting. We've got we actually maintain a transportation finance database at the Humphrey School that kind of looks at sort of some of these questions and so forth. I'll point out that by our estimates, the gasoline tax currently pays a significant part, but not all, of the funding for roads and bridges throughout the state and in local areas. So there are a number of other existing sources already. But as I mentioned, there are ways to think about how can we handle this in a new way, starting the conversations, seeing what's happening with electric scooters right now. St. Paul, as I mentioned, has an agreement that it receives an amount per vehicle per day. but you could also sense these vehicles earn their money not just from when they're checked out, but for the distance that they're driven. They're making money for the company when they're in motion. You could consider that possibly the most efficient way to make sure we're receiving that revenue is that when they make money, the government should make a little bit of money too. So a fee that is related to the distance that they're used or something like that, that could be a new option in addition to a number of these non-motor fuel tax-based sources that exist right now.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Duma, my question is, and this may be outside of your preview, is there a study on how many jobs would be either increased or decreased with automated vehicles?
Mr. Duma.
So we lose taxi drivers, possibility, buses, and so on.
Mr. Duma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hall, they're probably in the long term we would see a change away from taxi drivers, possibly even bus drivers or truck drivers, in the same way that in 1980 the most common job in the United States was a secretary. Over time, we can see we may see the labor force change. To my knowledge right now, we are experiencing a shortage of drivers both in the trucking industry and in rural transit at the very least. So the first deployment of vehicles like this would be filling a demand that is currently not being met rather than replacing existing jobs.
Senator Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Duma, I've got two questions. I'll ask them right away, and it's kind of exciting to go down this road. My question is one you may be able to enlighten us on is who's currently paying to charge these vehicles? Do they have a credit card slot or something? And then the other question I have is, are they ever looking at putting meters on these charging stations to collect a kilowatt equivalent to a gallon so we can tax this and collect the revenue to replace our gas tax as it goes away, and we can charge these electric vehicles for doing the same work?
Mr. Dunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Howe. The main way that people are paying right now to charge the electric vehicles they have or that's paid for is either that they're paying for it when they through their current utility bill when they charge at home, and then there are a number of charging stations located in any number of places that are currently funded by either owner of a parking structure or a city or anybody who wants to kind of put it out there to be able to show that they're friendly to electric vehicles. To your second question then, could it be metered or something like that? That would probably be a question. I have not explored it either with people I know at Otter Tail Power or with XL Energy. But that may be a possibility. The motor fuel tax is collected at the wholesale level by the state, so it's a relatively efficient tax. So the ways that you could be able to collect a similar set of revenue from a similarly small set of sources so that you're not spending a lot of time and money trying to collect from individuals would be something that could be looked at.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very interesting technology, but I wanted to ask a question. Do you know about latency and lag within the computer systems that are going to be inside of these vehicles? I just got booted off my Wi-Fi here twice while we were going through your presentation. I have real concerns about the computer systems that are going to be on these. Of course, they're going to be a lot faster than the old Commodore 64 that we all had at home when we were kids. But there is still questions when we're driving, perhaps even at high speeds, latency and lag of the computer systems, or that latency lag between the computer systems and a wireless network. That, for me, is pretty concerning because things happen in split seconds in the traffic world. And do you have any information on how these automated vehicles would be dealing with that type of issue?
Mr. Delma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Osmek. My understanding and my training is not in computer science, so I will not give you the best possible answer, unfortunately. But there's two pieces to this that I do understand. One is that the technology, as it's deployed, already has reaction times that are faster than humans. So this is seen in insurance companies are already picking up significant drops in both severity and number of crashes in vehicles that are equipped with the automatic braking systems. So in some cases, the technology, while there may be some latency in there that I don't know about, is able to outperform what we see at the human level. The other is to look at the guidance from USDOT about these vehicles. Is they are very, very emphatic about the need to have these vehicles be safer than what is currently available and developing standards that would ensure that.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really like some of the things that you're saying about the electrification and how far we're going with that. And I just confirmed that with electric vehicles, they're already paying a $75 a year surcharge on their tabs. And so I don't have any problem with converting to electric vehicles because they're today, with a $75 surcharge, they're actually paying more than gasoline-powered vehicles. But I do have a problem with us talking so much about self-drive vehicles without looking at what really is the direction we should be going. And I recently went through one of the reports of it, and it sure sounded an awful lot like PRT from the past, where every answer was PRT, personal rapid transit. And that was something that I had a lot of misunderstandings. And I think what we need to do is we need to make sure that we fully understand self-drive cars. They're going to follow the law. They're not going to speed. They're not going to make last-minute cutoffs, things like that. That actually, they're not safe, but they do get more traffic through a particular area. And also, they're going to be confused by things that they're not programmed to fully understand that a human mind could. So you could, the more self-drive vehicles that happen on 35W, the easier it's going to be to shut down the freeway with a beach ball. All you need to do is throw it in front of some of these self-drive cars, and they're going to just say stop. So I have a problem with that. I also have a problem with us talking about all of the people who today cannot drive cars and now are going to be able to be in automobiles because of the self-drive. And I'm leading to a question here that have you a forecast of what the additional congestion is going to be by having more people on the road, more people in vehicles that are going to follow the law, and this access of being able to even have a driverless car come and get you from work? When we talk about not needing parking places, that means something else to me. So that's one question. But then the other one is, are we looking at the places where the self-drive really can do something today? I don't want to irritate anyone who might be our friends in labor, but, we have the Green Line here that has a driver on each of those vehicles, and maybe that's a good place to start. We have buses that are on fixed routes, fixed stops. They know how to drive, and maybe we should be looking at that and having reports on what it's going to take to turn that into self-drive. Then we have highway trucks that haul freight. We have railroad trains that have a specific track that they can drive on. Are we looking at that as well? Because I think the self-drive automobiles that are going to be on the street with my cars that are, that a lot of them are old, and I'm not ready to sell them yet, We're going to be mixed in with these gasoline-powered, human-powered, rather inexperienced drivers and new drivers, old drivers, all of that sort of thing. We're going to be mixing them on the roads. But I'd like to know, what is the congestion forecast, and will that mean that we need to have more money in transportation? And then also, what is the forecast of things, of projects that go to the more easier to solve issues? I'm going to say one more thing, and that is that I just came back from L.A. a week and a half ago and sat next to a very skilled young entrepreneur that is working on some of these issues. And we talked about what is a possible solution to this, too, because we already have companies that are working on it. Amazon today can drop off a package at your front door by air, by drone. So it's doable. We already know that self-drive cars and their positioning is very precise. So if we have this very precise positioning and drones, we can skip going on to the roadways. So I guess I'd like to have you react to some of that.
Mr. Dama, good luck.
Thank you, Senator Newman, Mr. Chair, and Senator Carlson. If we had another half hour, I've got another presentation that could handle many of those questions. To try to get to the core of it, first of all, I appreciate you sharing the information about the current flat rate for electric vehicles. That is entirely correct and should be part of the conversation. Regarding how we deploy the vehicles, I think that you get into a level of detail that is probably being discussed in about 100 different presentations at the Transportation Research Board annual meeting this week in Washington, D.C. We need to have that conversation about what are the advantages we want to see. And I did not bring the slide of level 0 through 5 in terms of the development of this technology, where level 0 is my first car in 1988 Dodge Omni, and level 5 is a self-driving vehicle that can go anywhere at any time. What we really are working in the world of right now is level 2, which is a vehicle where somebody needs to be continually monitoring, so that if a beach ball comes out, or as happens in the case in Minnesota, some snow comes from the sky, the vehicle does not stop. The human can override and operate safely. The other option is level 4, which is what we saw with the Easy 10 and so forth. And these are vehicles that operate, and also actually Waymo is trying to do in outside of Phoenix, operate in a very limited area where they are able to control for some of those things, including unpredictable human drivers. What I see is particularly exciting when it comes to the ability to provide additional transportation options for people who can't drive is to be able to use some of these level 4 low-speed vehicles as shuttles in areas between places that people can't drive. What are their high usage areas, high places with lots of origins and destinations of trips that you could create a route that these vehicles would run? This would be something that complements existing transit service rather than replaces it or anything immediately, but it's a chance for people to see a new service, a new benefit, and a new technology all in a way that they can be more comfortable with.
We've got one follow-up question from Senator Hall, and then I'd like to move on to Ms. White's presentation. So, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you see a greater wear and tear on roads or less with electric vehicles? Part of that is there's an exhaust coming from a combustion that probably affects and gets on a road. Any thoughts on that?
Mr. Dama.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, you're starting to getting me to try to talk like a transportation engineer, which I'm not, so I'll put that caveat out there. The one piece I can address is that while we are talking about vehicles being in use much more potentially, and this also somewhat goes to Senator Carlson's question, we aren't necessarily talking more vehicles or more trips. We could be if we end up in a situation where people are sending their cars back home after they've been dropped off at work. But if the vehicles are being shared and they take you to work and then they go pick up someone else and take them on their trip and then they go somewhere else to go on that trip, you are not necessarily adding a great number of trips or wear and tear on the infrastructure. You are just being more efficient with the vehicles that are doing them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Delma. I really appreciate your coming today. Your testimony may generate more conversation with members, and if they indicate to me that they'd kind of like to have you come back and talk to us again, maybe we could convince you to do that. But again, I really do appreciate your coming.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, and I do have my contact information there because in case it didn't come across, I love to talk about this in whatever situation happens to work out.
Thank you very much. Ms. White, if you want to come forward. I'm gonna have Ms. White identify herself and proceed. And I will say that perhaps if we don't get done in time, because members easily could have questions for you, perhaps you could come back because we're going to have another follow-up informational hearing on this topic in the future. But thank you very much for coming. If you'd identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Kristen White, and I am the Connected and Automated Vehicles Innovation Director at the Department of Transportation, an office that we just originated last year to respond to this rapidly advancing technology. And today I'd like to talk about two things. One is to give more context when answering the question, what is a connected and automated vehicle? And two, to provide some context about the recent Connected and Automated Vehicles Advisory Council Executive Report, it's a mouthful, which was released in December, which contains over 100 recommendations on proposed changes to law, rule, and policy here in the state of Minnesota. So I will not repeat what my esteemed colleague, Mr. Doma, shared with you, but here in Minnesota, we are viewing automated vehicles in a much broader perspective. And so we consider four main elements in the conversation, and they include automated vehicles, as we've talked a little bit about already, but connected vehicles, which actually are different in which they install technology such as broadband or cellular technology, which help the vehicle communicate to other vehicles, other pieces of infrastructure like traffic lights, or even other road users like pedestrians, persons with disabilities, and other cyclists. Now, electric vehicles are, as we learned this morning, a critical part of this conversation, and the infrastructure impacts to things like in-lane charging systems, which could lead to wear and tear on our road systems, are something that we believe we need to consider as part of this general conversation related to automated vehicles. But as Mr. Doma also represented, part of this conversation must include a conversation about shared mobility and the shared economy. And so when we in MnDOT and in my colleagues in the state agencies talk about automated vehicles, we talk about all of these elements together under the Connected and Automated Vehicles Program, or CAV. But as Mr. Doma mentioned, I want to explain a little bit about what a connected and automated vehicle actually looks like. And he mentioned these slides, and I want to share these with you. This is an important part of the terminology that the Society of Automotive Engineers took place several years ago to help us understand what is an automated vehicle and what does it look like. And so we are starting, of course, as Mr. Doma mentioned, from a period of time when where there was no automation, where we had to steer and operate the vehicle. However, most of us move up to a level one when we have cruise control in our vehicles, because the Society of Automotive Engineers holds that in and of itself is an automated vehicle. Now, it's not something we think of typically, because the cars manufactured today in the environment where the industry is competing towards the newest and best technology include things like lane keeping assist, which might audibly or visually warn you if you're moving in the lane, or things like emergency braking. It takes much, much more technology to move to that level two, which is advanced automation. And we are already seeing some of these commercially deployed. Mr. Domo referenced the Cadillacs, but here in Minnesota, we're seeing many deployments of the Tesla Model 3, which includes interesting technology called autopilot mode, which, when used, allows the human operator to remove their hands from the steering wheel, remove their feet from the pedals, and the vehicle in pre-mapped and pre-programmed routes on interstates will actually drive the car by itself. However, it is critical with these technologies that the human operator remain cognizant of its surroundings and immediately be able to take control of the vehicle if, for example, a beach ball came down the interstate highway. Now, moving on to levels 3, 4, and 5, that's the conversation we're talking about in these committees, talking about highly automated vehicles. These are the vehicles of future transportation mobility. Currently, the level 3 vehicles, which have even more advanced automation than the Tesla Model 3 I gave an example of, are not even allowed for testing in America because the federal government deems them too dangerous because of the amount of human operation and visual management that the human operator must oversee at all times in the vehicle. And as studies have shown us in areas like California and Arizona, these human drivers are unfortunately too reliant on the technology, and that leads to safety challenges. Which is why here in Minnesota, we've been focusing our conversation on these advanced levels of automation, levels 4 and 5. Many of you have either participated or already learned about this Easy Mile shuttle demonstration we conducted last winter. And this vehicle, as Mr. Doma noted, had no steering wheel and no pedals. No human could have taken over control of the vehicle. However, it provided advanced mobility options for people who were blind or people in wheelchairs. Now, those have two limitations currently as they're being tested across the country. First is that these are only really limited to low-speed 25 to 35-mile-per-hour routes. And two, they are only allowed to operate in pre-programmed, pre-mapped routes where stops are programmed into the software of the vehicle. So these are ideal for corporate campuses, maybe city blocks, and they're being demonstrated in areas such as California and Arizona. So the future then really is our conversation about this self-driving car, a level 5 fully advanced vehicle where there is no ability for a human operator to take control and the vehicle can go anywhere, anytime. The real question, as Mr. Doma mentioned, is when will these be deployed? And throughout the work under the Advisory Council, which I'll touch on in just a few moments, we had in-depth conversations with original equipment manufacturers and the technology companies that work with them. And while many of the industry's information is privately and competitively withheld, they agree that it will be some time, 20, 30, maybe even 40 years until we see these vehicles tested and deployed on our roadways, which is why the MnDOT Office of Connected and Automated Vehicles and our sister agencies are coming together as a coalition to plan for that future. But one area of this technology which hasn't been mentioned is what's called connected vehicle technology. So Senator asked a very excellent question about latency and how vehicles plan for that. Well, this is actually a connected vehicle challenge that is being addressed in one of two ways, by either installing cellular technology like 5G or radio technology. And while the industry is split on which way these two technologies will go, many states like ours are viewing that this technology should be interoperable to make sure that those safety challenges are addressed as quick as a human would be able to address them themselves. But what's important is that states like ours believe that it's this combination of automated vehicle technology and connected vehicle technology that creates a connected and automated vehicle, which is the safest means to test and deploy this technology. So I want to just briefly share how these vehicles actually work and operate. And as you see in the center of the screen is a typical vehicle that might come off the assembly line. Here's an example of the Waymo Chrysler van. But many, many different types of technology are added onto this, including a very expensive and sophisticated central computer, which may contain machine learning or artificial intelligence. And importantly, that computer then integrates radio, global positioning systems, cellular technology, and very sophisticated cameras around the perimeter of the vehicle to detect objects, as well as LiDAR, which essentially just pulses out rays of light to help the vehicle understand where the lane markings are, if it's dark or rainy, and in cold weather conditions, as we saw with the Easy Mile shuttle this winter at Mint Road, allows us to determine whether or not it is a snowflake in front of the video camera and thus can continue ahead, or if that is in fact an object and the vehicle needs to stop. Now, this is why we don't see a lot of these vehicles on the roadways, because these technology systems are continuing to be updated. And while they are being tested in some states, which I'll touch on in just a few moments, the technology is not validated to be safely deployed, which is why now is the time for us to have these conversations. But one of the things I want to touch on, too, is we talk a lot of our examples about passenger vehicles. But as many of your questions already asked, we are thinking more broadly about how this technology could impact a variety of industries, including commercial vehicles. So while there is a driver shortage, we do see that there are many opportunities to reduce the fatigue and stress on commercial operators in what is called connected vehicle or truck platooning, which uses connected vehicle technology to electronically link two of these vehicles together, allowing the human driver in the lead vehicle to caravan with two to three other vehicles behind it. This increases fuel efficiency and also decreases driver fatigue and driver stress. But most importantly, as Mr. Doma mentioned, part of this conversation is about mobility. And with that comes automated transit, automated microtransit, and many different ways to address the needs of greater Minnesota who might not have all hours access to transportation. So in Minnesota, we are asked often as state agencies, why are we thinking about these questions? And the common theme we hear when talking with the public are these five answers. First and foremost, as Mr. Doma mentioned, safety for an engineering organization like ours will always be an utmost priority. And we believe that by reducing the ability for human error to cause fatalities, we can meet the state's goals of towards zero deaths. But next, we also believe that by reducing transportation barriers with automation and connected vehicles, we can actually increase access to a wide variety of communities, to low-income communities by making it affordable and allowing more people access to this transportation for those that might have disabilities, but also making sure that our tribal nations have the ability to learn from and benefit from this technology. But very important for the Advisory Council was the idea that we can actually harness the economic benefits and business opportunity here while balancing it with the potential workplace impacts. I heard a question from one of the senators regarding potential job displacement, and Securing America's Energy First, SAFE, is a think tank out of D.C., and last summer they actually released a report saying that drivers' jobs will, in fact, be displaced. The time yet is unknown. However, these jobs might just transition into something very different than what we think of today. We might not have human operators of vehicles, but we might have training programs to help them be shared mobility managers, data analysts, or other individual careers that could support this technology. Now, for MnDOT, as an agency that manages and helps to manage our road system, efficiency is very important for us and our colleague agencies like State Patrol. And with automation and connected vehicles, we believe that we can better address congestion management, incident management, and even severe or cold weather conditions in our state. And last but certainly not least, in a conversation about electrification, it's very important to note that we actually believe that this technology could help the state meet its climate and sustainable goals, but we also believe it allows us to rethink how we plan for our communities to impact public health and allow greater access to public health. So when talking about connected vehicles in Minnesota, we try and put ourselves in context. And we are looking at 29 other states plus the District of Columbia, according to the National Conference on State Legislatures, which have passed automated vehicle-related legislation. Now, not all of these blue states have necessarily authorized automated vehicles to be deployed or tested. However, they have either created testing programs or they might have created task forces like our CAV Advisory Council. On a related note, I mentioned truck platooning. 23 states have to date passed legislation authorizing truck platooning, which is essentially an exemption to the state's following distance law, allowing these vehicles to convoy more closely together. So this leads us to the Advisory Council, which I want to thank Chair Newman and Senators Dibble for being ex officio members. This Advisory Council was created last March when the governor passed the executive order on CAV, and it essentially asked us to think about three different things. First, to convene an Advisory Council with members from private industry, the public, academia, transit providers, equity advocates, and industry to think about recommended changes to law, rule, and policy. Second, it asked our department and our colleagues at Public Safety to think about how to create a testing program to safely test automated and connected vehicles. And finally, it created an interagency connected and automated vehicles team where all of the executive agencies can work on these issues together. Because as we learned in our initial conversations last year, this is not just a transportation issue, but CAV can impact many different policy areas, including whether or not we need to rethink drivers' licensing and registration. Because if, in fact, a level 4 vehicle does not have a steering wheel, state law should perhaps not require a human operator to have a driver's license. We also need to think about impacts to insurance and liability if a collision occurs. And as my colleague, Mr. Doma, noted, we also talked a lot about data and privacy impacts. So all of these 10 policy areas were divided into policy subcommittees where members of the public, experts, state agency staff, and organizations interested in these issues convened over the last 6 months to ask the question, how do we start moving this forward? In those conversations, we focused on 6 main themes, and these are the themes that I will share with you today. And I wanted to share with everyone the December 2018 executive report on connected and automated vehicles. I brought additional copies today, but it is also available on mndot.gov/automated. There are over 100 recommendations that were formalized in this report, and I'm only going to be able to share just a few that might relate to you and your committee and constituents. First and foremost, the Advisory Council recommended updating and clarifying our state policy to make it clear whether or not it is allowed to test in Minnesota. And the Council recommended creating a joint program overseen by MnDOT and Public Safety to see how we could issue a permit to safely test automated vehicles. In addition, they also recommended a permit program to oversee truck platooning. Next, the Council believed that it's critical to continue this conversation, to build public trust and expertise on this issue. And so they recommend continuing the Advisory Council in some way, shape, or form. Next, they also believe that these policy subcommittees that were created that included members of the public, experts, public and private organizations should continue to serve as resources for your committee and others throughout the state and to help build statewide expertise on this topic. Next, they also recommended drafting a CAV public engagement plan because, as we know, there are many, many questions relating to this topic. And getting out and producing outreach and materials for people to understand this, but also to be able to ask questions, will be critical. And last but not least, while the interagency team was created and has been convening regularly, we believe that should be expanded to be more inclusive, to include representatives from local government, from tribes, and from universities, such as my colleague, like Mr. Doma. Next, we looked into really specific policy areas. And just for some background, each of these policy subcommittees was led by a public cohort and a private cohort or member of the public. So Driver and Vehicle Services worked with the Council on Disability and Drivers Education Programs to recommend that the state should rethink its driver's licensing laws to contemplate a time when, if a vehicle does not have a steering wheel, we may not need to require a driver's license for that vehicle. Next, accessibility and equity were a common theme among the 40-plus meetings that we had throughout the state, up from Grand Portage all the way down to south of Rochester. And they all in these conversations advocated that we must conduct pilots with things like the Easy Mile Level 4 automated shuttle to allow the public and communities to learn about this technology and also to ensure that all communities have the ability to learn about it and voice their feedback and concerns. Just a few final recommendations I wanted to share with the committee to think about. Revenue, as we know, will be a critical part of this conversation. And so partners with our Department of Revenue and state tax experts recommended creating a public and private working group to think about the very questions you asked today, to think about how we supplement and diversify our transportation highway funding and how we fund these programs to research and deploy these programs. Next, we worked with our Minute and other private cybersecurity experts to address 2 topics to recommend updates to Chapter 13, the Government Data Practices Act, to think about how do we protect consumers when private information is contained within these vehicles? How do we collect data from entities that might traditionally not want to share their data if a collision occurs? For example, the auto industry has told us that they're very concerned with disclosing information within the vehicle in the event of a collision because some of that software is proprietary and intellectual property. So we need to develop a safe system to allow them to do that while protecting the public. And finally, how do we protect these vehicles from cyber attacks? Last but not least, I wanted to conclude with two remaining recommendations. First and foremost is we partnered with the Teamsters and the Department of Employment and Economic Development to think about updating and reimagining our current training programs to ensure that drivers or other workers who would be displaced have opportunities to find new career paths. And second, to create a talent pipeline, because CAV is going to be a conversation for many of us long into the future, and we want to find careers for younger people to understand how they can benefit and learn from this technology as a career path. And finally, we worked with insurance representatives from across the country and within Minnesota and the Department of Commerce to formulate recommendations on minimum liability coverage for these vehicles. To date, they are recommending $5 million liability, minimum liability, to operate or test an automated vehicle, but that could dramatically change as this technology is changing every 6 months. And finally, we do not have a state regulatory structure to understand who is liable in the event of a collision. Is it the human operator? And if it's not the human operator, is it the original equipment manufacturer which created the vehicle, or the technology company that created some of the components, or all of the above? Benefits to the consumers is going to be a very grave concern to the insurance industry, and they want to know what information they can collect to ensure that their users are protected. With that, I want to thank you for your time. We have conducted extensive research on this topic, and I'm happy to answer any questions or share the resources for you. And I again want to share that we have brought additional copies of this report if you would like to see one. Thank you.
Ms. White, I want to thank you very much for coming today, and I would ask for a copy of that report if you wouldn't mind when we're done. We are out of time. If any members have questions that they would like to ask Ms. White, let me know, and I will ask her to come back, and I'm sure that you will do that. In the meantime, my one request is regarding the advisory council. I assume that is going to continue to move forward. But if you could provide the committee with a bullet point presentation of recommended legislation that we should be looking at in order to allow this advisory council to move forward. I suspect that there is some legislation that is being recommended, and if you could outline that for us specifically, get it to the members, let them consider it, and then maybe we'll have you come back and talk to us again.
Yes, thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for coming. With that, members, we are adjourned.